but not all. So we relish the opportunity to give you a day at the library, and while you're doing your other important work, a chance to explore this remarkable small library, newly renovated, and to perhaps come back another day with your students and learn more about what we do. You're going to be treated in the early part of the program to my colleague Abigail Altman telling you something about our special collections and our archives. I have that right. And I want to say special thanks to Abigail and to Pauline Lemasson and Audrey Chapuis and Grant Rosenberg for organizing this program. I hope you have a wonderful time at the library, and now I believe it's Francie who's going to speak to you.
So thank you, Charlie, and thank you for saying pretty much what I was about to say. We obviously didn't coordinate this. I do want to give a ginormous, that's a word in the dictionary somewhere, thank you to the American Library in Paris for hosting us today, completely free, free of charge. Wow. It's a lovely thing to do. To Grant Rosenberg, who's still working, the techie of the day, to Charlie Trueheart for suggesting that we do this many moons ago, and we're finally doing it, in the newly renovated space. This is an amazing space now. It was before, but it's incredible now. But I want to actually give the greatest thanks to Pauline Lemasson and to Audrey Chapuis, who not only welcomed us, but did, I would say, half the work, including your restaurant list that you have. Most of those restaurants came from them. And the Starbucks this morning, Pauline went and got it herself, brought it back, and got us a discount to boot. So thank you for that. Standing in back, by the way, so you know who they are. This is Grant Rosenberg over here. Charlie introduced himself. Last but not least, I would like to thank in advance Abigail Altman, who's right here, who's going to talk to us a little bit about the history of the American Library, which dovetails with the history of study abroad in France as well.
Thank you. Thank you very much. We're very happy to have everybody here today. I'm Abigail Altman, and my job here is I'm in charge of the collection, and I'm in charge of reference, and I also host some of the student orientations, so when students become members of the library and they need an introductory tour, I'm one of the people who runs it. Audrey Chapuis, my other colleague, runs tours for students as well. We're very happy you're here in this recently renovated space. Is there anybody who's already a member of the library or who has been here before? Okay. So, not so many people, I think. My first experience with the American Library was when I did my own study away program, or my own study abroad program. I was with Tufts University in the early 90s. It was a French-only program, and we were enrolled at Paris 3 and Paris 4, where we were expected to read Gide and Cocteau and Sartre, and it was impenetrable. Nothing had prepared me to even make any sort of headway in these books. I had heard about the American Library, although we weren't members of the library since it was a French-only program. And I came one day, and I snuck in. Don't tell anybody. There was nobody at the front desk. I snuck in. And I spent the entire day hiding in the stacks reading these French authors in translation, hoping that I wouldn't get caught. So now, many years later, I'm paying penance, I work here at the library, paying back for that day, and also those, I'm here because of the formative year I spent in study abroad. It's the reason I've been now here in France for 18 years. I'm going to give you a brief history of the library and our services and our collection. We're starting to prepare our centennial. But even before we were founded in 1920, the library played an important role in the literary life of Paris. The American Library Association during the First World War had the War Service Committee, which collected money and books to send to servicemen who were here in Europe. They collected over 1 million books and money. Well, originally, I think they wanted to just raise money to buy books, but then they collected books as well, and sent more than 1 million books to Europe through Paris warehouses and a main building in Paris on Rue de l'Elysée to dispatch to the front, to camp libraries, and to hospitals for the American servicemen who were here in France. When the war was over, it took quite a while to return all of the books from the front, back through Paris to the warehouses. And in the meantime, the Paris operations, which included a library that the servicemen used, remained open. It was for the use of the soldiers. And you can see in the back, as you go towards the restroom, there's an original poster that welcomes servicemen in Paris to come and avail themselves of the library. The library was also used by the American colony, the expatriates who were still in the city, and French people and other nationalities who were living in Paris after the war. So the American Library Association told the community that they would be willing to leave the tens of thousands of books that were currently housed in this building in the 8th arrondissement, leave some of the equipment, and leave enough money to run the library for the first year if they could raise the money for the library to become private, to become a private nonprofit institution not associated with the American Library Association anymore. And that was able to happen. A call was put out, the community came forward, and everybody donated and expressed their interest in maintaining this library in Paris. One of our first founding members and the president of the Board of Trustees was Charles Seeger. He was the father of Alan Seeger, the poet, who had joined the forces in, I think, the Foreign Legion in 1916 to fight for France before the Americans had engaged in the war. He wrote his very famous poem, "I Have a Rendezvous with Death," and then he was killed in battle. And one of the founding principles of the library was to honor the Americans who had fallen for France, to keep France free. We were also founded on the principles that we were a place to promote English or American literature in France, American ideals, information about American culture, and also American library practices. French public libraries at the time were pretty grim places. You sort of knocked on the door and the books were behind a curtain and the hand came out and gave you the book and you gave a list of what you wanted, and it wasn't very friendly. People were very surprised that we had a reading room, that there were tables, there were chairs, there was light, there were open stacks, it was arranged by the Dewey Decimal System, there was a kids department with small tables and chairs.
And friendly staff,
yeah. If you read some of the articles from that era, they talk about how amazed they are, how helpful people are. They willingly will help you find what you need. Yeah. The French were shocked by that, absolutely. So our motto in the very beginning was Atrum post bellum ex libris lux, from the darkness of war, the light of books. And that's still written on all of our book plates that are in all of the books here on the shelves today. We, since 1920, are a private nonprofit association. And like many universities, we're constantly begging for money. Membership fees only cover 25% of the cost of running the library for the collection, for the staff, and for the operations. We rely very heavily on donations, our annual fundraising campaigns, for grants, and also money that comes in through institutional partnerships. I know I'm not supposed to give a plug, but I'm giving a little plug. So all the institutions that do partner with us and bring their students to the library throughout the year help us maintain this institution, hopefully for another 98 years longer. We are the largest English language library on the continent, and very early on, I believe that we were the largest. The opening collection grew to close to the size it is now, about 100,000 items within the first few years. Besides the motto, from the darkness of war, the light of books, we have a second tagline we use, which is literature, learning, culture, and community. So I just wanted to give a quick overview of those. We are a daytime library and a nighttime library. During the day, we operate like a normal public library. We're nice and quiet, and people come to study. And then in the evening, we have programs which are more lively. We allow people to talk in the entire library and come and participate in evening events. For literature, we're very proud of our heritage, of our associations. Edith Wharton was one of our first trustees. Gertrude Stein was an early member. She was apparently very mad at Sylvia Beach for publishing Ulysses. Mm-hmm. So she marched in one day and relinquished her card at Shakespeare and Company mm-hmm. and said she was bringing her custom to the American Library instead. And we know that she used the library when she was writing the libretto for Virgil Thompson's opera, The Mother of Us All, that's recorded as well. We know that Ezra Pound didn't like us very much because he accused us of not carrying very interesting sort of avant-garde magazine, the American Mercury. He called us right bank pigs for not carrying it. But I have been in the archives, and we do have this magazine, and we've had it since the beginning, so he obviously didn't come and check. Henry Miller had a little dictum pinned up above his desk which said, steal good books from the American Library. Hemingway wrote for our newsletter, Ex Libris. George Orwell has a character come to the library and read magazines, and the list goes on of these luminaries who were part of the library's history. And even today, these authors are obviously on our shelves with the other classic and contemporary authors, but we have published and aspiring authors who come to use the library regularly, here in the reading room working and then standing behind the podium giving presentations during our evening events. What else? Yeah, our collection, as Charlie mentioned, it's a small collection that's equivalent to a small American public library, heavy on the liberal arts. For universities, we do sometimes put aside course reserves so we can function a little bit like an off-site, home away from home, I call it, an off-site library for students as well. We've always promoted self-study here at the library. The original camp libraries had collections that were very heavy in technical subjects and trade information for soldiers who needed to prepare for life after the war. Some of the camp libraries actually taught soldiers, primarily African-American soldiers, how to read. And even today, we find ourselves to be a base for people who are interested in sort of this autodidactic self-study. For students who are doing distance programs, we offer exam proctoring. So if somebody is studying at a home institution, but they need to have an exam done under specialized exam conditions, we are able to host that for them as well. For students, we do believe that the library should be their home away from home. It's a place for them to congregate and study. We're open 54 hours a week. We're open late on Thursdays. We're open on Sundays. We have Wi-Fi, we have cheap coffee, we have comfortable tables. We're better than Starbucks. We're better than the chambre de bonne they're living in, and we're better than the host family's living room. So even if it's a French-only program, this is a place where students can come and work. Our physical collection is brimming with reliable sources. We have specialized librarians who are able to help students who are doing their research, and also to help students find resources in Paris that aren't held within our collection in French and in English. We know the other libraries, we know the other collections, so we're happy to function as the reference librarians for anybody who's a member. We do have online resources as well that are not as robust, I think, as the resources students can access at their home institutions. Mais on parle français, et si vous avez un programme qui est uniquement en français, je suis très contente d'aider aux étudiants de faire la recherche en français et leur apprendre tous mes fautes. But yes, we can accommodate French-only students. For the culture aspect of the library, as I mentioned, we do have evenings with an author. It's generally once a week, sometimes twice a week. We do about 70 events a year with well-known authors, journalists, artists, scholars, and other thinkers talking about current events or talking about historical topics as well. We have Colson Whitehead coming, we have Viet Thanh Nguyen coming, we have Judge Margaret McCown coming, and Nixon biographer John Farrell coming, and I think that's all in the next 10 days. We have book groups. The book groups are held in English, although there generally is one book group that talks about contemporary French literature. So they do read the book in French, but then they discuss it in English. We host an annual book award. We have visiting fellows come. We were very fortunate to have Ta-Nehisi Coates come and be our visiting fellow and be in residence here, as well as other important thinkers. Those events, those programs are sponsored again by grants. You can follow us and all of our programs on the website or by signing up for our newsletter or following us on social media. And lastly, I wanted to just talk about community. The library is not just for Americans, in spite of our name. We're only about 25% Americans. Not everybody is a native English speaker either. We have members of all ages, of all backgrounds, of all reasons to be here in Paris. Their students, their children, their families, their retirees, their long-term expats. They've just been sent here for the year. We really try to cater to all of these constituencies. We think of ourselves, as I said, a home away from home and a beacon for during hard times as well, providing essential services for the community. We stayed open during World War II when French libraries were required to close. We had a branch on the Left Bank which catered to French students when their university libraries weren't able to host them after the war. And in the 1950s when McCarthy sent his henchmen to the library looking for anti-American materials, we didn't let them in the front door because we are private and not affiliated with the government. Community is important for students as well who maybe have a community service obligation or need to do volunteering or interning. We have over 100 volunteers every year who come and help in the library, be it setting up for evening events, shelving books, helping in the kids department. So that's something that's available to students as well who need to fulfill that sort of requirement when they're here. So I want to thank you again, and I hope you enjoy the day's program. As my colleague said and Francie said, we're all here to answer questions about the library. We hope your students develop an attachment to the city and to us in particular. We think there are worse places to devote our time and energy. And you never know, somebody might have a life-changing experience on your program and end up being my successor. Thank you.
De ce qui vient d'être dit. Ce soir, au moment du cocktail, si je ne me trompe pas, ceux que cela intéresse pourront avoir une visite de la bibliothèque. Donc il suffira d'en parler à Pauline ou à Audrey en fin de journée. Voilà, donc nous sommes là tous les cinq parce que nous sommes le comité organisateur de cette conférence aujourd'hui, Voices 2017. Un comité qui s'est créé il y a un peu plus d'un an maintenant et qui donc a choisi ce thème de la génération Z. Puisque c'est notre population depuis maintenant un an et demi. L'idée, au fil de nos discussions, était d'adresser cette question de la génération Z pour à la fois la définir, mais aussi déconstruire un peu les définitions et les préjugés que l'on peut avoir sur ces jeunes personnes. Alors, définition pure et simple, des jeunes qui sont nés à partir de 1995, c'est l'une des définitions que l'on rencontre le plus. Pourquoi ? Parce qu'on considère que tous ceux nés à partir de cette date n'ont jamais connu que Internet, les médias sociaux et l'ensemble des technologies dont nous profitons et que nous subissons tous depuis ces années. Ça a des impacts sur leurs pratiques, sur leurs comportements, sur leur façon d'être et de faire, notamment dans le contexte des études à l'étranger, on le sait bien, on l'a observé, je suis sûr qu'on a tous vu depuis quelques années des évolutions dans leur manière de consommer, d'apprendre, de se comporter dans nos programmes. Et donc c'est ces aspects-là que l'on voudrait interroger avec vous aujourd'hui dans l'idée d'un échange. On n'est pas là pour faire de vous tous des spécialistes sociologues de cette génération, mais plutôt de mettre en pratique à travers les intervenants et nos discussions ce que l'on peut savoir et ce que l'on peut faire avec nos étudiants. Je crois aussi qu'on est tous d'accord pour dire que le but, ce n'est pas de les enfermer dans une catégorie, dans une définition qui serait limitée, enfermante et réductrice, mais plutôt de nuancer, de voir un peu les différences que l'on peut observer auprès de ces jeunes gens. Vous avez reçu au cours du printemps une enquête que l'on a construite ensemble alors qui n'a aucune prétention sociologique, vous imaginez, c'est un questionnaire, en fait, on s'est posé des questions sur ces jeunes et on a voulu leur adresser ces questions pour mieux les connaître. On vous remercie d'avoir d'ailleurs été les relais de cette enquête, puisqu'on a reçu au final un peu plus de 350 réponses, ce qui donne une masse critique satisfaisante pour justement discuter les résultats que vous avez reçus. Ces résultats, on peut vous les présenter rapidement, mais vous avez tous reçu la synthèse de cette enquête. Que non, ce n'est pas ça. Je ne suis pas de la génération Z. Voilà. Donc c'est un document qui sera évidemment téléchargeable sur le site de la PUAF. Et qui synthétise l'ensemble des résultats par rapport à cette enquête. Donc, bon, on va pas les détailler, mais on a synthétisé ici à la fois les données quantitatives et les réponses qualitatives que les étudiants nous ont données. Ils avaient la liberté de pouvoir exprimer leur opinion, donner leurs réponses sur les différentes questions posées, qui typiquement concernent d'abord le type de programme qu'ils ont effectué en France, court, long, semestriel, annuel, dans quelle langue et selon quel modèle pédagogique, échange, cours à l'intérieur d'un programme ou hybride, expérience de stage ou de volontariat, etc. Ça nous a permis de mieux les cerner. Vous avez sans doute vu d'ailleurs que la majorité des étudiants ayant répondu étaient plutôt des étudiants au semestre, dans des programmes immersifs en français, ce qui fait que l'un de leurs objectifs restait malgré tout l'apprentissage ou le perfectionnement de la langue. Et donc, on peut considérer qu'ils ne représentent pas totalement la population que nous accueillons en France, les uns et les autres.
Surtout du printemps,
d'ailleurs. On a ensuite voulu leur poser des questions sur leur pratique, leur rapport aux technologies, les différences que eux-mêmes observent dans leur pratique sur les médias sociaux, Internet, entre les États-Unis et la France, et il y a des différences intéressantes qu'on pourra discuter ensemble. Leur pratique du voyage, parce qu'on a tous observé depuis quelques années des différences dans leur consommation de voyage pendant leur présence en France, et puis leurs objectifs et l'accomplissement de ces objectifs à travers leur semestre ou leur année en France. Donc on espère que vous avez pu parcourir ce questionnaire de manière à ce que ce soit aussi une base pour discuter tous ensemble, et ce sera l'un des éléments justement de la discussion avec la première session de cette conférence, qui est justement un dialogue avec trois étudiants qui ont accepté d'être présents aujourd'hui et qui vont du coup porter leur voix pour cette génération et qui sont ouverts à vos discussions. Dernière chose, évidemment, si ces étudiants sont nés en 95, on doit réaliser qu'ils ne sont que les pionniers de cette génération. Autrement dit, ne tirons pas de conclusions trop hâtives parce que la suite arrive. Et ce sera intéressant d'ailleurs de refaire peut-être l'enquête d'ici 5 ans pour voir les différences entre les plus anciens de cette génération et leurs cadets dans quelques années ou quelques semestres. Voilà, moi j'ai trop parlé, je vous laisse compléter si vous voulez. Non, pas de... Alors peut-être on peut se présenter nous rapidement quand même. Mathieu, Sylvie, moi-même, Thomas, Francie et Marianne avons eu le plaisir de travailler ensemble depuis un an pour organiser avec la Bibliothèque américaine à Paris cette journée de conférence. Voilà. La première donc session de cette journée, c'est justement ce dialogue avec trois des étudiants qui ont fait un programme ici en France très récemment. Donc Fiona, Elisabeth et Jessie, si vous voulez bien venir vous asseoir. Ce que l'on se propose de faire, c'est d'abord peut-être de faire la discussion en anglais, puisque vous avez fait des programmes dans les deux langues. Vous présenter pour commencer et ensuite donc peut-être nous donner vos premières impressions sur l'enquête, en quoi elle fait écho ou pas à vos propres expériences, et ensuite on compte sur le reste de l'audience pour poser des questions. Voilà, merci. Les étudiants s'installent. Ce que vous voyez là, qui est inclus dans les résultats de l'enquête, c'est un word cloud que l'on a construit à partir des réponses des étudiants à qui l'on a demandé les trois mots qui, selon eux, définissent leur expérience. Et donc, les mots les plus gros sont ceux qui ont été les plus récurrents dans les réponses. Et ça méritera discussion, je pense.
What are we doing wrong?
Ready?
Yes.
Okay. Hello, everyone. I'm Jesse Tanson from the College of William Mary. I did a study abroad program this past semester in Strasbourg with the IFE program, which is a program that differs from other study abroad programs in that it focuses more on immersing students in French culture via the workforce. So what happens is students take 5 weeks of class to kind of help them understand the political, cultural, societal, like, milieu of where they're at. So in Strasbourg, we learned about its history, we learned about general French culture, but then we also learned about France as a country in the EU and the EU as a whole and what it was about. And then after that, we did 3 months of internships. So everyone's internship was based off of what interests they had. So mine were based off of were in the domain of cinema. So what I did was I interned with a research group at the University of Strasbourg, specializing in the promotion of cinema in Africa and the Middle East. So what I did was I helped create a database of articles and things like that. And I also attended conferences with film producers who produce mainly African and Middle Eastern films. And then I also worked with students who at the University of Strasbourg who helped create the site for the research team. And then my other internship was at Cinéma Odyssée, which is an independent movie theater in Strasbourg, which is it's one of the oldest still running movie theaters. It's one of the oldest, one of the five oldest movie theaters still running in the world today. And there I was kind of like an employee. I kind of helped sort things out. I helped. I had to, you know, count films, had to organize data and things like that. And so for us, at least in our program, the immersion really did come from the workforce experience. I personally I spoke most of my French during that time, during the internship period, and more English obviously during the class period, because we were a big group. We were 15 students, and as a group of 15 students, you have French levels varying from, you know, lower, like middle, intermediate to more advanced, and depending on the comfort of in different individuals, that determined whether or not you spoke French with them or not. And then also just the fact that we were so many kind of created an atmosphere where we spoke largely English amongst one another. But like I said, it was, during the internship period that I did speak French. So in the beginning, I met a group of students from the University of Strasbourg. And during that time, the period where I went to the conferences and things like that, that's where we spoke the most French. That's where we bonded, where I felt that I assimilated the most during my time in Strasbourg. And then also at the movie theater, talking to my fellow coworkers, my boss, the person at the cast register, the people who would come into the film library, and things like that. Looking at the survey, a lot of the responses I expected, a lot of them. One in particular was how folks used technology differently. It wasn't necessarily all about just, you know, being on Facebook and Twitter, posting status updates and things like that. It was also just, you know, again, like people said, using Google Maps to find out how to get to places, using the internet to find things to do in the city. Also just in the same ways, but also in French. So meaning that, for example, shopping online, right? You go on Amazon and it's the French Amazon. You go on all of these different websites and it's the French version. So it's not necessarily that using technology, it wasn't always in English, that's to say. And also, for example, Netflix. You know, lots of us watch Netflix, but it's the French Netflix because we're in France. And then you switch the language to French, you put on the French subtitles, you have more access, in my opinion, to more French items being in France with technology. So to see how people use technology differently was completely expected, in my opinion. And then on, for example, travel, I think it was also expected to see many people traveling outside of France, but I think something that would have been interesting would have been to have asked what motivated them to travel outside of France, because for us in Strasbourg, the city is right on the border with Germany and Switzerland, and oftentimes it was more expensive to travel within France, which is what a lot of us would have liked to do, which is what we wanted to do. But when you just want to travel, when you're in Europe and you just want to travel and you don't have a lot of money, and it makes more sense financially to travel outside of the country, then that's more than likely what you'll do. And then also at the end of the survey, lots of folks seem to have developed more as people, and which is what I found for myself. And I think depending on the program, how much French you gain, it's all about the program. If you are in, because I have friends who are in more English-based programs, and they developed as people, but their French, you know, either stayed the same, or it got worse, or they didn't. they didn't put the effort necessary into kind of assimilating, because they had that bubble and their classes were in English. Everything they did was in English. You know, they go to the restaurant, they can get by without, you know, you just point to the item. You know, so for them, it really wasn't useful, I guess, or so to speak, in terms of learning French. But then again, in our program, we also had sort of the same issues, just talking to people. Some people felt that their French didn't really improve, but they developed more as people because, you know, they didn't talk or they didn't go out, or or they, you know, again, they were just scared. Then we also had people whose French did develop a lot more, and those were the people who, it wasn't necessarily that they spoke, let's say, less English, but it's that they spoke enough French to kind of counterbalance. And what that means is, for example, we had a student in our program who would speak with their parents pretty much every day, all the time, you know, updates, yada, yada. But that person also had an internship where they communicated with people constantly. They went out with their coworkers constantly. They were always immersing themselves in the culture. So the fact that they did talk to their parents in English a lot didn't necessarily counteract the amount of French progress that was being made. And it's more about getting that French experience. And again, another obstacle that we faced was kind of meeting people. So in Strasbourg, there was kind of like this cafe that you would go to on Tuesday nights, and it was kind of a language exchange. But what would happen a lot of times is you go, and then they find out you're an American, and then people just want to speak to you in English. And then exactly. And so that was an issue. And then so I think maybe to counteract that, I guess maybe just have students from the university come and say, oh, hey, here's where we go, here's what we do, do you want to tag along, do you want to come here, we can show you these kinds of things, because these are tools that I find would be useful for us at study abroad students in the future and such.
I'll continue. I'm Elizabeth Taft, I'm from Wellesley College. I'm originally from New Hampshire. I'm a French major with an English minor, and I just spent the last two semesters in Aix going to classes at Aix-Marseille University. I was with the Wellesley Next program, so out of the eight classes I took over the year, two of them were with the Wellesley students, Those were in French as well, though, but they were kind of support classes to help us adjust. And the other six classes were at AMU. And I was living with a host family, which helped me enormously. I found that I really liked having technology to be able to talk to people at home. Just going abroad for a year was very intimidating to me. I knew I wanted to do it because I thought this is the time to move to France and to stay there as long as possible. But I also, going in, I was very afraid of not having like regular contact with the people I'm close to at home. So it was very nice, honestly, to be able to send my parents, hey, how are you doing today, and that kind of thing. I generally would have like one phone call a week with them where I'd just kind of catch them up on what I was up to, and vice versa. Honestly, that was really nice because a lot of people were having family come visit at some point, even if they were there for one semester, and I didn't. So I was like, this is a way that I can share my experience with my parents, who are the reason I'm here, even though they can't come and like be here with me. So I really appreciated having the technology for that. And also, I just, you know, send my friends silly things and Facebook Messenger, that kind of thing. So I used the technology as a way to connect home. But I also, I did like look for other ways to counteract that by, you know, reaching out to the people around me. Like, one thing that I tried to do was find a choir. That was very difficult. I found there's not a lot of choir culture in France. And I eventually did find one, but that was like towards the end of the year. And so we exchanged numbers, and then I was like, well, I'm leaving next week. So it was nice to meet you all. But one thing that also helped was in the second semester, my program set up a language exchange kind of program where they recruited French students, basically, who wanted to practice their English, and then we would practice French with them. And so I met with Alex once a week, and we just talked and sometimes ran out of things to say, but then we would keep going. So I found that really helped. We'd exchange vocabulary, and I'd be like, what did you just say? I understood none of that. But that was a really, really good thing that helped me meet other French people, too, and just feel more anchored. And within the program, I guess I'll talk about my host family. They were very sweet. Sometimes I felt like technology was a bit of a barrier between us because it was something I was used to having and they just didn't use it as much. So I think sometimes they were like, why is this girl on her laptop all the time? And I, you know, I had to explain, it's where all of my work is. It's where everything I do is. And so I think that was just a bit of a cultural difference. But otherwise, I think having a host family really helped me, again, with counteracting the technology, because even if on the internet I could like get English all the time with my host family, I really had to speak French, you know, so this was one thing that could not be circumvented. And I think it also, the host family and with having a language buddy, that just helped me feel more integrated, because it is difficult to, I found it difficult to break into the social life at the university, because it's not, there's not the campus life like in the US. So I'm used to easily finding people in the US who want to make friends and want to like do co-curricular activities together. But in France, it's just very different. They don't have as many social events happening. They don't really have social events happening on campus. So I just had some trouble like, breaking into that. So another thing that helped me with that was, not with that exactly, but I did an internship with Festival Tout Court, which is it's a yearly festival of short film in X. And so they had me translating things for them into English. And so that was a great experience that, you know, got me into the cultural life of X and got me speaking a good deal of French every day and doing translation work that I really enjoyed. One thing that I found was interesting in the survey was there was, I don't know if you noticed this in the comments, but there was a student who said, yes, I'm addicted to my phone, but not any more than my mom. Which I thought was kind of funny, because I definitely have seen the same thing. My mom does not really know how to use her phone, but my dad loves to send me the moving pictures that you can do on your iPhone now. And he likes to be able to see where I am, because you can show like your location on your phone if you want to. You don't have to. You don't have people just tracking you unless you give them your location. But like my dad was really happy he could see on the map like where I was living in Paris when I moved here. So I think that's kind of been a comfort to them, that if they ever were to lose touch with me, they could kind of look up where my phone was and see that, and maybe that would make them feel like everything was a little bit okay. And it's just nice to be able to send them pictures from time to time. For communication, I mainly was using, I was just texting them because that was over the internet. There weren't any cell phone fees associated with that. We also used FaceTime, which is just the iPhone equivalent of Skype, same thing. But I usually just did it for phone calls. So that was a really easy way to get in touch. But I also wrote a lot of postcards to my grandma and to just various people back home. So apparently she still has them. I also noticed in the survey a lot of people talking about just their motivations for studying abroad. I think that was like the first page. And a lot of people said that it was for personal development reasons. And some people said it was for educational. It was a good percentage, but I think more people said it was for personal development than for education. And the two are linked, of course. But for me, it was definitely far more for my education. The personal development was a nice bonus that I noticed along the way. And I think it was an important step because, honestly, before leaving, I was very, very anxious. And I love my college. I love the community I have there. So if I could have put it off, I probably would have, but I knew that this was an important thing for me to do as a French major. I really wanted and needed to spend time here, and that's why I decided to do the full year. So it was interesting, but not unexpected, to see that more people went for personal reasons, I guess, than educational. And kind of related to that, the travel question, because a lot of my peers were traveling like every weekend or every other weekend, and that was kind of strange. And I stayed in X for a while before I started traveling. And it's a big temptation just because, like, you're here in Europe, and this is the cheapest it's ever going to be if you want to go to Berlin or London. You know, you're not paying for the transatlantic ticket. But it was, I took like 4 major trips and that was kind of it. And I think that was a good thing. It helped me really get to know X. But I also found it was kind of refreshing. It kind of gave me a new confidence when I would come home to my host family and tell them everything that I saw. And so, yes, it was a break from French, but it also was kind of nice for me as a person. And I was usually traveling with Americans, though I did spend the holiday with my host family in the Southwest. So I don't know if you want to take over.
Yeah, sure. So my name is Fiona Palmer. I'm from St. John's University. So I study government and politics, and I just finished the spring semester here in France, in Paris. It wasn't totally geared as much towards language as these other programs seem to be, because all of my classes were in English. And then I'm staying this summer, and I'm working for the university as an RA, and then I'm also taking a French class at the Sorbonne, because I think I just, like, staying here and being here, I just, like, developed this, like, bigger interest in wanting to learn French, and I'm just like, oh, I don't want to be that American speaking English all the time. So I'm trying to work on that. And then, yeah, and then I'll be heading back to St. John's to finish up my degree in the fall.
I'm so sorry. Can you speak up a bit?
Yeah, absolutely. Sorry about that. We'll try. Yeah, but just in reference to the survey, a lot of the things have already been talked about, but I thought an interesting thing was being tech reasonable and about, you know, when they asked, like, oh, students, like, how much do you actually use technology? And I think this is something that young people would say that they don't use it a lot, but in comparison to people who might be older and not of that generation, like, we don't think it's a lot, but you guys might think it's a lot. So I think what one of the people running this organization commented on was that, like, wow, everyone says they're tech reasonable. And, like, we are. Like, we think it's normal. We think to, like, flip out your phone 10 times a day is, like, okay, because it's like, well, I'm using Macs. And then, yeah, another thing was, like, how many hours are you on your phone? Like, I don't think I could calculate the amount of hours that I'm on my phone because it's, like, 5 minutes, 10 minutes here, just, like, flipping it out, looking for directions, looking for, you know, metro stop, where is, like, believe, things like that. They're just, like, absolutely essential to daily life, which I think is another interesting part of our generation. Like, technology for me is, like, definitely an essential part of every day. Like, just getting here, like, I need to figure out, oh, where's the Bleep station? Let me just, like, flip open the app and check it out. And then in comparison to millennials, which is really what this is about, right, that shift from millennial to Generation Z, I was talking to another RA who works for St. John's, and he would qualify in the millennial field, and we were talking about phone plans, because he was like, your phone plan is way expensive. Why do you pay so much? And I was like, because I want data. And he was like, you can live your life without data. And I'm like, no, I can't. So I think definitely something that's, I'm not sure if you guys have that on your phone, but I think it'd be pretty impossible. Yeah, you, all right. So it'd be pretty impossible to, like, live here and not have it just because I think we're so used to the convenience of it. So, like, before I leave campus, I may not have directions to where I'm going. I just know I'm going somewhere. And then I may have, like, a general idea about what part of Paris I'm going towards, but, like, you know, I just figure that out as I'm walking. So I just, like, start and I go. And I think in terms of technology, you know, is it inhibiting our, you know, opportunity to study abroad, or is it making it better? I mean, I personally think that it makes it better just because there's no fear about where I'm going. You know, if I get somewhere and I'm very lost, you know, it's very easy to look up and figure out how to get back. And then also, it's super easy to grab an Uber. Like, that's such a convenience, is that doesn't matter where I am or what time of night, I know that I can, like, have a car meet me in whatever, 5 minutes, 2 minutes, depending, and take me back to, you know, St. John's campus or wherever I need to go, you know, safely and efficiently. So I think that's just a really important part about study abroad. And I definitely think it has a positive impact, which I think is a bigger question of this survey. What else? So in terms of, I thought this was funny, but in terms of, like, the different apps that we use, there was also a section like, oh, what apps do you use at home? What do you use more here? The app that was least used in both sections was LinkedIn, which I thought was pretty funny, because, like, young people don't use it.
What app?
LinkedIn. I'm sure you guys all have accounts. Maybe, but another one that I thought was funny, because I think a struggle with study abroad is, like, meeting French people, and, like, how do you break that ice, how do you break that, like, barrier? And so I knew a couple people that tried to use, like, Tinder to meet people, so it's like, that's how you meet people locally. So I feel like these, like, apps that help you interact and are based off of, like, your location is what gets you the most involved. So things like Snapchat, where it's, like, the newsfeed that you get is only French. You can't change it to try to get a newsfeed in New York. It's just strictly French. And that's also, you guys mentioned that with, like, internet servers. So, you know, as soon as you go on the internet, it's automatically in French. Granted, like, you can hit the Google Translate button, but, you know, try to be a little French. And then, let's see, so that's just different apps. I mean, I'm sure you guys use Instagram a lot, and things like that are, like, good for communication. And then another switch between apps would be, like, I definitely don't text nearly as much when I'm here because I'm using things like WhatsApp, or I'm using, like, direct messaging on Instagram or Facebook Messenger, like you mentioned. So I feel like these different apps took on a whole new role being here, something that I would never utilize at home, because it's kind of like, why would I use data at home to message on Instagram when I could text somebody because I'm paying for texting? So I think it's just utilizing technology differently and more efficiently and more effectively. Then in terms of travel patterns, I think that because of Instagram and because of this, like, you know, whole generation of I need to put on a performance for the world type of thing because people care about my performance, is traveling to as many countries as possible. I'm not sure if it was just like my program that had this, but a lot of students would be like, I traveled to 10 countries in 4 months. What did you guys do? So I think there's a lot of pressure to travel. And then it's also, there's a fear about traveling as well, which I think is quelled a little bit by technology. But I think that also makes people want to only travel with Anglophones. So I think that's a little bit, I guess, harder to break the ice between like cultural exchange. But I think that's like the best way to do it in terms of safety. And it also makes your, like, your parents feel better. Mm-hmm. You know, like I think if I, when I travel alone, you know, I get like 10 phone calls versus one, so from the parents, so that's good. And then also, yeah, I think the amount that people travel depends on your program. I mean, you guys were in internships, right? So like how much freedom did you have to?
I was the only one internship.
You were alone, okay.
The others were just doing classes.
So it was easier for them to travel, you thought?
Yeah, but it also depended on how you built your class schedule. So there were some people who were like, I'm only going to have classes Monday through Wednesday, and I'm going to take off on Thursday.
Yeah, precisely. So my program was just Monday to Thursday, so every weekend was a long weekend. So there's a lot of opportunity to travel to major cities in Europe, like Berlin and like London. And I think that was another trend as well, was that people were just going to major cities. But,
yeah,
how did you feel about, you know, traveling with internships, and you seem pretty busy.
So it was pretty much on holidays. So like Fête du Travail, like all of those holidays were really when people did most of their traveling.
Right.
Sometimes folks would go places for the weekend, but it'd be, you know, maybe like a 2-hour trip to like some small town in Germany because it was right there. But most of the big traveling was during holidays. And then right before the internship year, we had a week to kind of do all of that major traveling, which a lot of people took advantage of. But yeah, during the internship period, it was not very many people traveled, unless if it was a holiday.
Right. And I think, especially with my program, it was that people would go every single weekend to different countries. I mean, I thought that was exhausting, and I could never do that. But I think it's very dependent on what you got going on and, you know, your class schedule. And if you're an internship, obviously you have to be there Monday to Friday. So travel patterns, I think, are very, you know, can vary. But from what I experienced, it was, like, often and, like, everywhere. And then I think a final part of the survey touched on, like, goals and as well as, you know, linguistic things. I thought it was interesting that a lot of people... majority of people came for linguistics, but then right behind it was personal growth. I thought that was interesting. And then, let's see.
Oh, yeah, about the three words.
Three words.
Would you like to show
this? Yeah, this relates to that protection.
How do you react to the results? Fun?
Yeah, for sure. I think this is, like, along with maybe my first semester of college, it's probably just, like, equally or more fun. So.
But what is fun?
What is fun?
Abroad.
I think there's a lot of freedom being here, and, like, the class schedule, mine being Monday to Thursday, just allowed for there to be a lot of free time. And also just to explore a lot more and to get into goofy situations because you don't know the language or whatever the story is. But I don't know what you
think. I also think people may be kind of saying fun when they mean something else, like exciting or more freedom or, you know, because fun is, it's just such a simple word. So they may just be saying, oh, yeah, I just had fun. But I think for me... the parts that were fun were mainly like, wow, this is so different and exciting, and I could never do this at home. this is an experience I would never have at home. So it may just be people kind of simplifying it into one three-letter word.
Thoughts on fun? What's fun? Tell me.
Same thing. I think also just you're just being constantly hit with new visuals, like new sights, and you're being hit with new sounds all the time, and you're living. I think you're more independent when you're abroad. At least we were. So you maybe like back home, like students wouldn't necessarily have to go to the grocery store and buy things, but here you get to go to the grocery store and you get to see how a French grocery store is organized versus how an American one is. You get to see how restaurants work and things, just little things like that. I think getting to experience all of those differences and all those like subtleties is what makes study abroad fun.
Yeah. And even going to museums or beaches on the Mediterranean, like these are things we do on vacation. So I think sometimes that just fun is what comes to mind. It almost feels like an extended field trip at times.
And then what else? I think disappointment was an interesting one, because I know some people who didn't enjoy this experience, and that wasn't my personal view. But I think disappointment, you'll get somewhere and it'll be close. And you'll be like, oh, I messed up. I didn't read the map, or I read the sign wrong. So I thought that was interesting, because mostly they're pretty positive, or at least the big ones are pretty positive. But,
I also can see disappointment, because then you have words like transformative.
Yeah.
And sometimes I feel like, because the study abroad, at Wellesley, 50% of the junior class goes abroad usually. So it's almost expected that you go abroad, and sometimes people build it up into the study abroad changed my life. It was the most beautiful experience of my life. And so I feel like sometimes people build it up, and from there I can see where you could be disappointed.
Right,
and
right.
Because you get there and you find out, oh, it's just real life, but in a new place.
What else?
We noticed wine, very
wine.
Small,
yeah.
Next to fun. And bread.
Cheese.
Yes.
Food's always good.
Maybe we can open to questions. So anyone should? Yeah. Laura and then Seth.
Listening to you all, it was interesting. Each of you said the word fear. You talked about the fear that you have. And we see scary. It's up there. But it's very little. So that's not something that is coming out of the experience at the end. And maybe that's a good thing. But I think it'd be interesting to talk a little bit about this fear that you have, and where's that coming from, and is it really fear that you're talking about, or is it a little bit of even anxiety?
Yeah.
To me, that's a strong word, but kind of being
or slightly out of control, or something.
You're uncomfortable. Right, uncomfortable. Yeah. Can you talk a little bit about?
Yeah.
What you're afraid of?
Well, for me, it was the biggest, culture change that I've ever experienced. I'm from New Hampshire. I've never moved. I've switched schools a few times, throughout my childhood. So I was used to being in, new social situations, but I'm very much New England, always lived in New England. Kind of love it there. Kind of hate it sometimes. But, it was, what I was used to. And so So just coming here, I had this kind of absurd, oh my God, what if I open my mouth and no one understands me? I've been taking French, but only in a classroom. What if just no one understands me? So I think just that, and just in feeling like social scripts were slightly different, and not, just being totally kind of fish out of water at first, I guess, is what I would say for my particular fear or anxiety.
I guess, I think my fear would come from just, not knowing people, but, all the fears that we would have had about, somebody can't understand me, or I don't know anybody, is all, quelled within the first few weeks of it, because all that, all that's worked out. So I think that's why it's so small, because it is, an element of being here, the fear of something new, and it's fear of something unknown. But I think it dissipates, because you figure it out and
definitely.
You get going. Yeah, for sure. Any comments on that?
Mostly linguistically, wondering if folks will understand you, because you're used to, the classroom setting, you're used to, you know, all of your classmates, like, their accents, you're used to your teacher's accent, if your teacher's, like, not a non-Francophone. So when you get into that real situation, you're wondering, well, like, am I prepared for it, am I not? But then, like Fiona said, it does go away because people usually understand you. And you find that you understand more than you think you do. I think another fear is just, I guess, that, like, again, the whole study abroad thing, that it won't be, like, this magnificent experience that changes your life. I know in the beginning of my internship, I wasn't really sure, like, if this was going to be, it was going to be great, but as time went on, it became funner and funner and became better. And for other folks, it was kind of the same thing. They wondered if their internships were really going to help them, if they were going to learn any more French, if they were going to talk to anyone. But as time went on, those fears dissipated, and they were able to meet people, they were able to speak, and everything worked out in the end.
Yeah, I found that when I talked to people, if they didn't understand me, I didn't die, so I was okay.
Seth? Students have a lot of expectations for their study abroad, and their friends and family back home have expectations for the students, what they're going to do. And I know that a lot of students end up crafting their social media in a way to show their experience as what their friends and family are expecting. So I'm kind of curious, when you have gone on trips and things like that, you've posted pictures, as well as when you posted pictures of just your daily life in France, do you get more likes when you're traveling, or when you're at your
With likes, I can't really say, because I hate posting. I hate the pressure of it, so I just kind of lurk. And yeah, I just really like what you were saying about, like, the pressure of crafting a, you know, like, social media brand. I hate it.
Okay.
I can't do it. So I just, like, I just post very rarely. But yeah, I think when I mean, I can definitely compare abroad to home, and I think, yeah, I think people are more likely to hit like or whatever if, wow, you're in front of the Eiffel Tower, you know, like, that is exciting for people at home. And also, I just find, like, traveling is kind of expected at this point, so, like, I think even my mom has said, people will ask her, oh, what's Elizabeth up to, has she been traveling, like, where's she been? And, you know, I know when I talk to adults, I'm like, where have you been? And I'm like, well, France. So it's definitely an expectation.
Yeah, so I also didn't really post much, unless if it was, like, to change my profile picture or my cover photo. But, and yeah, I guess I did get more likes, but I think it was just because there were better photos in general. Yeah, but I did see a lot of my other friends who did study abroad. They were definitely trying to craft that persona. They would post, I have a friend who's in Italy right now, and they post, like, maybe, like, an album a day of photos. Like, I went to, like, Venice, I went to Rome, I went to this place and that place and this place and that place. So that crafting of that persona definitely is something that people do expect. For me personally, my mom did not want me to go abroad. And when I did go abroad, she didn't want me to leave the house. So me traveling for her was like, oh my gosh, could you not? But again, most of the pictures that I've taken so far, I just keep for myself to look at. Maybe I show them to, like, a friend or two, but it's really, like, just for me to, like, remember what I've seen and what I've done, and not to, like, be this grand superstar person that other folks try to be.
Yeah.
I actually have two questions. So we're seeing sort of a trend of some students who don't want to have phones or data. And you were talking about data earlier, Fiona. So I don't know if you guys have friends who prefer not to get data here because they don't want their parents to be able to track them. And they kind of want to take a break from technology. It's rare. It's a handful of our students. But it's still a trend that we're starting to see more and more each semester.
Yeah. I definitely met a couple people this last year who just, like, I found that they were kind of the same in there. I think they were kind of the same in the U.S. You know, they either didn't have a phone or they didn't have a smartphone or they just didn't like using it, so they just leave it at home. But, yeah, I'm definitely not that type. I wish I were. But, yeah.
I mean, I didn't meet anybody who was like that, but I think the people that they were like the older people, like the millennials who would say stuff like, oh, I'm not going to, that's too connected. Yeah, like, I'm too connected with social media and I look at it too much. But I don't know any students in particular in my group who were like anti-phone. I mean, I can see why they want to do it, but I think there's too many benefits to not have it.
Yeah, same thing. I didn't meet anyone who was like, no data. It was more, I can't afford data, so I'll just use I'll just use Wi-Fi when I can. And then I think also just the fact that we are so connected to technology, and then again, just like going back to family, our families are so connected to us via technology, that sort of like that sort of possibility isn't really, like, it's not really something that can happen, I don't think. Just like when you go from being able to be tracked by your parents to just cutting them off, I feel I think it creates more problems than it does solve them. So,
oh, you have two.
I have a second question. So, how can we, as study abroad sites, incorporate technology and social media to improve the way that we present information to you so that it's more receptive? I find that there's a question of attention span nowadays, right? Back then, people like to read long articles, PDFs, manuals. Now I feel like you want the information short bursts, quick, attractive. Like, how can we use that, perhaps some orientation materials to help you guys navigate Paris more or acclimate faster? Is that something that we can work on?
I think, my program used social media a lot, and I like following their pages, and I thought they put, like, very relevant things on the page. It would be like, oh, like, this is what's happening in Paris this weekend, and they would take, like, from, I think it's like the local FR and a couple different like sites, and I thought that was really beneficial versus this being like posted somewhere or being told to us in a meeting, because someone would be like, hey, there's a list on like the top 10 ice cream places in Paris, like let's go like scroll through the feed and find it and go look that up. So I think like definitely a short verse just saying like check out what's going on in Paris and putting an article was really like beneficial for my group, at least. I'm not sure how you guys, it was good to find like events and things.
Yeah, for
was
my.
Was it a Facebook page? Or?
Yeah, that was a Facebook page, and then the Instagram was more like photographs of what other students were doing, which also just like, cultivated interest in different places around Paris.
So these were closed groups?
Yeah, so I believe you needed like a St. John's email to get onto it, which is a really nice feature of the Facebook page.
How many people were in your program?
It depended, because like every 6 weeks, it, like 90 or, not 90, maybe 60 kids switched out.
Oh,
so,
okay.
But throughout the semester, there was 15.
Okay. For my program, communications were a mix of email, and there was also, like, a Facebook. So we had a group where our assistant director would post, like, events that she had found on Facebook that were happening around town. So I found that very helpful. Like, that definitely, like, was an easy way for me to find things to do. And otherwise, I found email worked very well for me. You'd have to ask my director how effective that actually was. but yeah, I think the more concise communications are with students, the more likely they are to read them and respond to them.
So for us, it was mainly emails and like the occasional like text reminder, like, oh, we're going to mess today. Be here at 9:45. I think with the emails, I think it's good to have them because you know where it is. You can get to the information. Like we got this huge packet of information that, although I did not read in its entirety,
Exhibit A.
I did have it, and I did go back to it, and I would refer to it from time to time. So that it was good to have that. So I think maybe a way to like. Interact with students would be maybe to have like a group chat. So you have, you create like a Facebook account for like the program, and then you create a group chat, you add all the students to it, and you can send messages to that because lots of students have data and they have Facebook Messenger, so it just pops up. They see it, they see the chat bubble, they open it, so they've at least seen it. I know IES has a Snapchat because I tried to follow it because they were having like a prize giveaway. I did not win the prize. I think that's also a really cool idea, just like to post like, oh, hey, here's this thing in this part of town, you should check it out, or hey, this thing is going on tonight, and you should check it out. So I think really using the same social media that the students use and kind of the same ways that they use them will help kind of make communication between students and directors easier.
I think like email just doesn't work. Like I might look at my email every 4 days. If so, like if you're telling me there's an event on Tuesday, I might not see it until Wednesday. So I think definitely, you know, using the social media that we're using is the best way to communicate.
Hey. I have a question about communication with friends back home. I am from a generation. we didn't have letters or names to our generations, but when I was a student in Paris, it was very rare to call back to the States, and there were these phones where you would put in, well, the second number was here, and these coins would drop down. Some of you remember those. And then I discovered that I was very observant, and I watched these African students who had developed a technique. I thought, God, they're on the phone a long time. And then I realized that they were attaching a thread to the coin.
Yeah.
And some of you might have known that you put your attached the thread to the coin, and the machine thought the coin kept going down, but it was the same coin. And so I thought, wow, this is great. And I did the same thing. I called everybody I knew. But then I realized, after I called my friends, it was like, you know, how are you doing? What's up? And then after a while, we were living in two different worlds, and there wasn't really that much to talk about.
Yeah.
Because they were living their life back in the States, and I was living my life in France. And, you know, after a while, the thrill of being able to call everybody disappeared, and I really stopped calling, except in emergency. So my question for you is, with this facility that you have to be in touch with people all the time, did you find also that after a while, there were less subjects of conversation, and that despite the facility that you have to communicate at any moment of the day or night, that in fact your desire to communicate diminished?
Yeah, definitely. I found, like, if I would actually call, which I didn't do so much, I usually just text my friends. But yeah, when I call, you don't have that much to actually say out loud. We kind of know what we're doing in our lives. Like, I don't usually need a play-by-play. But so it's more texting. It's more I'll just have a stupid thought and I'll send it to my friend and she'll see it when she wakes up. And, you know, it's more, hey, I'm still thinking about you. And yeah, it's nice.
Yeah, I think I probably called my best friend like twice the entire time being here, but we would talk. But it's like exactly what you're saying. Like, you live in totally different worlds. Like, she was like moving to DC, and so like we had a lot of things going on in our lives. But like after a while, there just isn't like similarities based on what we're doing day to day. So there's a lot more, like, there's very few long-term conversations. Like, if there was one, it was like for an hour. But it was mostly like, oh, I found this funny photo, like, let me send you this, or I thought of something really funny, or I'll be in a store and I'll see something really goofy, and I'm like, we need to get this for our apartment. So stuff like that. So communication is just short bursts versus these, like, long-term things. And I think that, you know, like, lessens the, like, disconnects of, like, what you're talking about how you have, like, less interest. It's like, there's always this, like, universal interest because we're all on Instagram, we're all on Facebook seeing the same things. And also, like, we're all connected with, like, news and stuff, so we'll comment on, like, hey, did you see this happen? Like, what did you think about this?
Yeah.
So I think connection with social media changes the way that, you know, you communicate, obviously.
Yeah. I don't know if it makes you miss them more or less, because you are still connected. But, yeah, it's definitely different.
Alors, peut-être, dernière question, Shelby, ensuite on fera une pause.
I wanted to know if your program required you to have a working cell phone.
Yes, but it could be like, it didn't have to be a smartphone, of course. They just wanted to have a phone to keep in touch with you, so you could, and a lot of people did just buy like cheap a little, all you can do is text or call. Texting was not easy because it was like the just 1 through 9 keyboard, you know. But yeah.
So this was a requirement?
Yes.
Okay. Is that uniform for the three of you?
Yeah, for us, also just because since we were doing internships, we were working. It was just really important for us to have French phones with French numbers. And so, yeah, people would, if they didn't want to buy a SIM card or if they couldn't get a SIM card to put in their phone, they would just buy, like, a small little flip phone and use that as their phone.
Yeah. My program wasn't required, but we had to fill out a form in the beginning to, like, give an emergency number, but I'm pretty sure you could opt out of it. Yeah, so we didn't have to, like, give a phone number, and I don't think we had to have a phone, but they did ask for our phone numbers, and I'm pretty sure you could opt out of it. Like, if you didn't want to give them a phone number.
Seriously?
Yeah, so Sipionos was St. John's, and the reason that we have that policy is because we found that it was a cost that we didn't feel we could force our students to bear. Mm-hmm. So many students opted to just use data on their phones from home. And if students did have a phone number, we do collect phone numbers for emergency purposes, or they sign a waiver saying, I'm aware that in an emergency, you may not be able to reach me because I have not provided you with a local or international phone number. So it's a way to protect ourselves, but I think it's a better option. We used to force students into getting a Pixel plan. They wouldn't charge the phones, they wouldn't top up the credit, they wouldn't carry it around with them. Or so what was the point? You know, it was just an extra burden on them financially.
Having to sign a waiver is a good idea.
But it's the same thing in Queens as well. Like, the public safety asks for our phone numbers, but we just sign a waiver and we don't have to give it, which I think is also a good, like, privacy aspect as well.
What would be a reason that you would not want to give them your phone number?
I don't really want to get, like, I think people don't want to get spam from the university. And I also think it's just a privacy thing. I feel like in an age where literally everything you have is out there, like, that's just one less thing that you have to give out. So, like, I personally, like, if there's something that I know that I don't have to give out, then I'm not going to give it. You know, just picking and choosing.
Sarah, tu avais une dernière question et après on arrête. S'il vous plaît.
Did you make friends with people of your age? French people of your age? How? And if yes, do you find a difference between French people of Gen Z and American Gen Z?
I mean, I can't say I made close friends. I made acquaintances. You know, I got to know my host siblings pretty well, but we also weren't very similar people, so didn't get super close with them. And I had, like, my language buddy and other people's language partners, and also people from choir. And just from observing these people, it seems to me that they use the same technology that we do generally, but just less of it. And also, like, they didn't use Google apps, for example, for college assignments. I'm used to just doing docs always for everything because it's so convenient, and they just didn't. And they had different phones. They tended to use more Android, which sometimes caused interesting interactions between different phone brands. I don't know. What do you think?
So same sort of situation, more acquaintances, I think. You'd get to, like, at the brink of becoming friends, and then, like, the internship would end. For example, in the beginning, when I hung out with students, it was just for a week. So right as we got lunch together, we went out for drinks together, but then everything ended, and then we just kind of, like, fell out of contact. And then again, I worked with another group of students, and then right as we were going to start hanging out and everything, the internship ended, and I had to leave. So I think it all depends. But in terms of technology, I think they use it fairly the same. One thing I noticed was that maybe this was just, like, with the people I was with, but French students tend to use more, like, pseudonyms on Facebook instead of, like, their actual names.
Yes.
Which was really interesting. And also really, like, funny.
I noticed that too.
Yeah, I feel like my interaction with, like, young people was type of limited. I feel like it was really hard to, like, break that ice, especially, like, the language barrier. But I think my university had something called, like, language exchange, which they'd have, like, French people come every Wednesday and we'd talk to them. So I think we use technology in pretty similar ways. Definitely, like, differences, like, with types and different apps and things like that, but I think dependence is pretty similar.
Yeah.
Merci à tous les trois. Étudiants restent là aujourd'hui, donc surtout intervenez pendant la suite de la journée, n'hésitez pas, et on aura sans doute d'autres questions à vous poser. Café, pipi, et 15 minutes en reprenant si vous pouvez la journée. Bon.
Thank you.